Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and this interview was recorded for the UK Wine Show. For the latest news and terms and conditions, go to ukwineshow.co.uk. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Rowan Gormley. How are you, Rowan?
Great. Good to see you, Chris.
Excellent. You're the founder of Naked Wines, and today we're going to be talking a bit about some of your marketing strategies. You won an Decanter Award for innovative marketing of wine, which is quite good. And you've set up a website. Initially, your website was focused on selling wine from selected winemakers. Do you want to just give us a quick overview of what you think your USP was when you first set up, and then we'll explore how you've marketed the business and how it's evolved a wee bit over the last 6 months or so?
Sure. When we first set the business up, what we decided to do was to build a business that was a virtuous circle, where the customers support the winemakers, which means winemakers can spend more time making wine, spend less time and money selling, which means they could give our customers better wine for less money. So everybody wins. That was the heart of the idea. One of the key things when you're going to be selling wines made by relatively unknown winemakers, because a lot of these winemakers are people who we've set up in business. They're not people with their own profile. So one of the key things about helping these guys set up in business is that nobody knows who they are. They don't know the person, they don't know the wine, often the region isn't particularly famous, so there's no public information to go on. So the critical challenge for us was, how do you get people to trust a wine no one's tasted?
Yeah.
And the way we had to do that was by making it a 2.0 site. In other words, a community website where anybody could say whatever the hell they liked about any of our wines, where the winemaker can speak to the customer can speak to the winemaker, and the customers can chat to each other. So we had to be completely open and transparent, which is where the word naked comes from. And when we launched, we were quite nervous about the whole thing, because we thought, what are people actually going to say about the wines?
Yeah.
And the thing we very quickly figured out was, well, first of all, most people were very positive. And we thought, what are we going to do when somebody says something incredibly negative? And the reality is, we just let it roll. We let it run. We let people say exactly what they think, partly because generally it's good. When people agree a wine isn't great, actually they're right. And what we do is discount the hell out of it, get rid of it, and don't repeat the mistake. And when you do get the occasional nutter who mouths off about something unfairly, in fact, the other customers jump on him and deal with it. So the core of our marketing strategy, if you like, is letting the customers sell to each other.
You spoke last week about setting up winemakers and all that sort of stuff, and I presume one of the advantages of doing this, as you say, is you can go to regions that aren't so famous. You know, selling a bottle of Chablis is sold on the name Chablis, but selling a wine from Jura or some quirky Nelson, even, you know, you got Heidi Seyfried in there, and from Nelson, which isn't exactly a famous New Zealand region either, because the wine doesn't have that cachet, it doesn't have that premium associated with the cachet.
Correct. So we can give the customer a bit of value for money, and the way we deal with the regional aspect of it, the less famous aspect, you're telling the story of the winemaker. And because customers can get online and speak directly to the winemaker, they know it's true. So for me, if you compare that to the experience of standing in a supermarket looking at a row of labels, you know a lot of clever people have spent a lot of time and money making the label look appealing. Mm-hmm. You know the pricing strategy has been carefully thought through to squeeze every last drop out of your pocket. You're a victim. And it's very hard for you to know if what the label is telling you is true. Mm-hmm. And very often when you get it home and open it, it's not. It's no. Just another mediocre wine.
Yeah, okay? Yeah, exactly.
The difference here is you can speak to the winemaker, you can speak to other customers, you can speak to people who've tried it. In a second, we should talk about the different types of customers, because that's an important piece of the equation. That's how people can build up confidence that the product is genuine, the winemaker is real, whatever their story is, it's authentic, often our customers turn up at our winemakers' houses and say, can I come around and say hello, and this kind of thing. And the winemakers are first astonished and then delighted. And quite often customers come back to go, you know, I couldn't believe it's just this young couple living in a little house in the middle of a vineyard making wine in a garage, and that's all it is. So I think by having this completely open, transparent approach where these people meet online, they meet physically, we've created a little family of customers and a family of winemakers who are helping each other.
When you first set up, though, obviously, I've read sort of all sorts of stuff on the internet about things, and when you first started out, you still were using wines from bigger, larger companies, and obviously that's a function of the fact that you can't start running from a standing, well, you can, but you know, you'll trip over, you need to build speed. What's the breakdown of sort of these sponsored wine makers now to more commercially produced wines, maybe labeled differently perhaps, or whatever it is, but from larger commercial operations?
About 80-20.
80-20, so you've still got a few of them in there. Yeah. Are you looking to phase them out over time?
Yeah, look, some things are hard to phase out because they're good. And
do get economies of scale.
Yeah, and, you know, for example, we work with an Italian producer where we spend months and months and months trying to find good quality product in Italy and just really struggled to find something that was better wine for less money. And in the end, we landed up working with a pretty big company. You know, on the website, it says, this is a big company. This is different for us. But it just happens to be that they happen to produce the best wine for the money we could find. But that is the exception. And, you know, there are things like, for example, you know, when we first launched, we needed a Chablis. And we didn't have a small producer. So we got a Chablis from a big producer.
Yeah.
But said, this is a big producer. That has now been replaced with someone, a Chablis from a small producer. What we do now is when we get hold of product, which is just very good value, but doesn't fit with what we're about, we used to sort of slightly holier than thou say, no, we can't touch this. What we do now is we just package it up and call it back door. So these are wines sold around the back door that are commercially available elsewhere. Don't fit with our small producer ethos, but we also don't want to say to our customers, you're not allowed to try these wines, you know. Mm. So where we make an exception to the rule, we say what it is. The thing we don't do is we don't pretend something is a small little boutique-y producer when it's not.
I don't know a lot of your producers, but, you know, being a Kiwi, I know a few of them. And you do Heidi Seyfried, and she used to be a dentist, didn't she?
That's right.
And then she became a winemaker. But she comes from the Seyfried family, which are a big company, you know.
Well, when you say they're a big company, they're a family-owned company.
No, don't get me wrong, but they are.
You know, so it's not Montana or someone like
that. No, I realise that, but they're still a fairly significant producer. And Heidi, obviously, is part of the family, but also I'd be pretty surprised if she's not making her wine in the Seyfried.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because it makes sense. Yeah. But the question is, are you helping her set her up, or is it a slice of the Seyfried family doing the business? Do you know what I mean? Is it a Chinese wall in there that says this is Heidi's wines, and therefore that's going to Naked Wines, or is it sort of a wee bit illusionary, that wall?
No. I mean, Heidi was a dentist and wanted to go back into the wine business. Chris was the winemaker.
Mm. And I know Chris quite well.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you taste Heidi's wines and Chris's wines, they're very different.
Mm.
And she wanted to do her own thing. So.
But it's all Heidi, you know, it's Heidi Seyfried's bank account the money goes into and all that, and she hires space from Seyfried's. Is it that way or is...
No. I'd say, you know, Heidi wants to do her own thing, make her own style of wines in her own way. So we said, great, we'll do that with you. And, you know, the product is different, the pricing's different.
Is it purchased from Seyfried's or is it from Heidi?
It's all done through Seyfried's.
It is through Seyfried's.
You know, I'll give you a few other examples. There are quite a few cases where we're working with big co-ops. And in each case, you know, the winemaker of the co-op is sitting there with access to fantastic production facilities, all kinds of interesting grapes. But because the co-op is in the business of selling high volume wines at the lowest possible price, is pretty much forced into following a recipe. Mm. Every winemaker, like every chef, wants to do their own thing, their own place, make wine their own way. And so, you know, it's been very good for us to go along to these guys and say, okay, make your wine your own way. And we'll label it under your name. Use the facilities. We pay the co-op. Use the co-op's financial facilities and everything else. But if you compare that wine to the co-op's wine, they're completely different products. So, you know, I don't think there's some kind of weird religious thing about us saying people have to be small. We've got a producer in South Africa who started off not small. I don't know what exactly the definition, but they're a family-owned business. They've tripled in size. They are now relatively a big winemaker. And they're big because we buy two-thirds of what they make. So should we now go, you're fired? Because you're so good, you're out?
Yeah, okay. No,
the thing we don't do is we don't do the trick of buying a standard wine off the shelf that is the same as comes from elsewhere, put 2 grams of sugar in it, change the label, and come up with a story. The key word we use is independent. So the things that excludes for us are big global companies, branded wines, the kind of wines you find in a supermarket. What we're trying to do is deliver better value for the money. Mm. So if we can't do that, and it's just a decent wine at a decent price, we've got a route.
You don't buy any bulk wine and relabel it or anything like that?
We do buy bulk wine, and that'll often land up blended in with something else to bring down the price of something to make it more affordable. So, for example, got a winemaker in the south of France who will make his own product, his own wines, and then, but it's expensive. And so some of it will be bottled and labeled as a premium reserve, and it's not cheap. And then to bring down the price point and make something affordable, we'll blend that in with some bulk so we can bring, so we can have an entry-level wine as well. But again, the entry-level wine is a step above what you would find elsewhere. I think the thing I'd be very comfortable about is if you line our wines up against a comparable product in a supermarket and did a blind tasting, would you say there is a significant improvement in quality? I'd be very comfortable that there would be a real step change. Again, just as a matter of interest, one of our competitors challenged us to a tasting, a taste-off, and said, you know, they're the real thing kind of thing. So anyway, we took the challenge. The taste-off was done. We both turned up, I think, with 20 customers apiece. And we won.
And what was like for like?
Like for like, you know, let's do an Australian Shiraz at this kind of price
point. Who was the competitor?
Oh, that's unfair. But if you Google them, you can find out. The reason our customers are coming to us and the reason they give us their money to invest is, can we produce better wine for the money? That's our mission. That's what we do.
Just do an example. Croft Pinot Noir, Croft and Martinborough. They're one of your wineries. And that they, I don't know them. I've never heard of Croft before, which is a bit surprising because I know Martinborough quite well. But
are they on Naked Marketplace or are they in Naked Wines itself?
Not sure. Is there a difference?
There is a difference. So just to explain, we've got this thing called Marketplace where any winemaker can pitch their wine directly to our customers.
Yep.
And we add transportation, duty, VAT, and charge a 10% commission. Mm-hmm. Okay. So the winemaker can picks the price, winemaker picks the volume, and it's up to the customers whether they buy it or not. So when you say Croft, it's not a name I'm familiar with. It's definitely not a wine we buy in stock. It's definitely not a winemaker we're financing. They could well be on the marketplace. You know, there are a lot of wines there.
Okay. I see what's going on. All right. Because it was quite interesting anyway, because just looking at them, because I had a look at their prices in the UK and prices in New Zealand and all that sort of stuff. And the price in the marketplace was fairly competitive price. It was actually a reasonable discount from what it's selling in Australia and what it's selling in New Zealand. But okay, so it's just it's not one of your wines, eh?
No, it's an opportunity for winemakers to pitch directly. So the price is their price. They pick it.
Let's have a look at sort of the marketplace. Marketplace is in beta, according to your website, so it's reasonably new.
Yep.
But when you first set up, it was all about these wines and all that sort of stuff. And you've done a lot of tie-ups. You've obviously spent a lot of marketing budget on it. I've seen promotions on the RAC website.
Have you?
The car people, yep. And I've seen sort of £50 off a case of wine, £25 off a case of wine. There was a website called The List, and you had a £50 discount coupon. And if you go to Amazon, even I think I got it from you guys as well, from Amazon, when I buy quite a bit on Amazon, and I got a 25% coupon from them. So that's sort of a classic sort of Laithwaite's type strategy of giving a discount to buy a case of wine, and hopefully they'll like it, and then they'll reorder and all that sort of stuff. Did you do a lot of that sort of strategy initially, and are you still doing that type of thing?
When you say we're spending a lot of money, I don't know where you saw the RAC thing. I honestly don't think that's us.
No, it definitely is. It's all right. Don't worry about it.
Okay. We don't spend a huge amount of money on marketing. What we do is give people a reason to try the wine in the first place. Mm. The biggest hurdle is to get people to give it a shot in the first place. And the easiest way to do that is with an incentive. So we do that all over the place. We work with all kinds of partners.
Even Mumsnet as well.
Yeah. That works. It's what we did from the beginning. It's what we'll continue to do.
Yeah, that's quite a classic sort of mail order strategy, though, isn't it? It's not a sort of Web 2 type concept. It's more of your standard sort of mail order strategy. And I imagine initially on, it's quite hard to get the volume initially, so you can get that sort of user interaction. Because once you get to a certain level, it will grow organically. But to get it firing in the first place,
no, that's absolutely right. Absolutely right. Yeah, you when you first get going, nobody knows who the hell you are. They can't speak to their friends. Once you build up to a certain size, people start going to other people's houses, drinking wine at the dinner party, and going, oh, that's really nice. Where'd you get it from? So people just start hearing about you. So it takes a while for the organic growth to come. And to get there, you've got to achieve critical mass. And to achieve critical mass, you've got to get out there and sell your wares.
Yep, so lots of sort of marketing early on. Are you still doing that type of strategy?
Yeah.
You're still doing it? And what sort of customer growth are you getting? Because you're saying earlier that you had 50,000 customers now.
We are, this year, we will probably over 100,000 people will join us.
Well, that's not too bad. How many leave?
Quite a lot. there's a distinction between customers and angels.
Yep.
Okay. So customers are people who come along and try it. And some people try it and like it, some people try it and go. And it's out of that pool we recruit angels. Once people become angels, they tend to stick around. And if they leave, it's very, very seldom. It's for any reason other than money's a bit tight. So they're kind of two bases. One of them, we're quite happy for people to come in, give it a try, maybe decide they'll buy a case at Christmas. But you know, that's entirely up to them. And then the other group are the angels, who are the core of the business, who get nurtured and really looked after, and where the loyalty factor is very high.
What I don't like about a lot of mail order businesses is that you land up buying a case every quarter or something like that. And I find it hard getting through a case of wine a quarter. I know it sounds crazy, but I drink a lot more than a case a quarter. But, you know,
also when it's not a case you've chosen, and, you know, the pattern tends to be the one or two great bottles of wine. There's sort of five or six mediocre, and then there's some stuff that you wouldn't have bought. So what looks like a good deal, when you actually look at what you pay for the wines you really enjoy, isn't such a good deal.
In terms of the social media-y side of things, one of the things that people said was quite good about your site initially was the fact that it tied in with the likes of Facebook, Delicious, StumbleUpon. How does that all tie in?
It's as simple as some people choose to interact by coming to the website, some people choose to interact by picking up the phone, some people choose to interact by going to our Facebook page, or on Twitter, for example. It's not a direct marketing strategy to be on Facebook or Twitter, because you can't use those channels to sell. You can use those channels to communicate with people and to build relationships. If they then choose to buy, that's great. But it's like a piece of string. If you push a piece of string, it bends. If someone pulls the other side, you can go along with them. So it's quite different rules to the old-fashioned direct mail where, you know, you mail people every 2-3 weeks and it's sell because it costs money to mail. The channel's free, so you're not under pressure to sell. So you, and if you do try and sell, it doesn't work. So you actually land up with a much nicer, less confrontational relationship with your customers. And curiously, in the end, they tend to be more loyal and actually buy more wine.
One of the things you guys set up was this marketplace, this beta marketplace that, it to me, it looks a bit like Groupon, and it is a deviation from your initial marketing plan. What was the reason for the deviation, and how's it working?
The deviation was because we kept getting approached by people who were making decent wines and but didn't need financial support. And so we weren't in a position to be able to go back to our customers and say, look, we've managed to get this wine for you cheaper, or we've managed to get the wine better because of your financial support. And the other thing was we kept getting customers calling up to go, I've got this fantastic wine, and I'd really like to be able to get hold of it. Can you get hold of it for me? And we thought, we felt like a barrier in the middle. And so we thought eventually, why don't we just let the winemakers pitch direct to the customers? And if a customer likes the wine, why don't we just let them tell the winemaker to come and put the wine on Naked Wines? We launched it about a month ago. And I think the honest answer is that it is working with our existing winemakers and our existing customers, which is there have been a handful of new winemakers who've come along. Mm-hmm. Well, there've been quite a few who've come along, but their ability to pitch the wine in a way that communicates really what it is that they're selling just hasn't been great. So some of them put up a stupid price, so of course no one buys it.
Yeah,
quite a few of them just, they don't really have any basis for the reason that they're selling. So,
is it a lack of a story, or is it a lack of their appropriate communication for the channel?
Both. You know, if people are selling something that's not particularly special, they're surprised it doesn't sell. Well, there's a reason.
Yeah.
So the stuff that has sold has tended to be where a customer's discovered it and has said to lots of people, this is a great wine, you should try it.
Because you're not going to get recommendations, are you? Because the people from Naked Wines you purchase normally won't know the wine, so they can't do your own social media.
So what we're trying to do is to focus on the places where we can get those recommendations. So, for example, we took 50 customers off to the London Wine Fair. Mm-hmm. Shortly, we're taking 50 customers to the IWC Medal Tasting Award. So people will get the opportunity to try these wines, figure out the sort of smaller subset that everybody agrees is the best quality product, and then we'll see how that works.
Yeah.
We're also saying to winemakers, look, if you want to sell proper volume, give us 5 cases and we will distribute those as samples to our best customers. Customers trust each other more than they trust anything else, more than they trust medals, more than they trust journalists, more than they trust Robert Parker. They trust each other. So if you have 60 people writing up a wine on a website and saying, this is absolutely sensational, the others will come along and join in. Mm-hmm. So we're going to find out. And once we've learned the lesson, this is why it's in beta. You know, once we've learned the lessons, we'll figure out which type of people to do business with and how to do business. One of the curious things we've found out is we built a bidding mechanism in.
Yep.
Where customers can say, well, if the winemaker wants £10 a bottle and they think that's too expensive, they can say, look, I'd happily pay £8, but I don't want to pay £10.
Yep. That's a bid down, isn't it? Bid lower and bid...
So you've got a choice of bidding the price the winemaker wants or bidding less.
Yeah. Yep.
And curiously, quite a few of our customers are saying they don't like that because they don't want to have the winemaker screwed. And we're saying, well, look, you know, just bid the price you think is fair. The winemaker doesn't have to accept it.
So if I bid like £2 under the price the winemaker wants, do I get that case? Or is it a case that the winemaker's happy to sell it, he'll sell it to me at that price? Or how does it work?
The winemaker, let's say the winemaker puts a wine on at £10. Mm-hmm. And 5 people bid for the wine at £10 a bottle, but 500 bid at £8 a bottle. If the winemaker says, you know what, I'm going to take £8 a bottle and shift 500 cases, they can do that.
And everybody gets?
And everybody gets the low price. They have to do it during the bid, during the auction itself. So, you know, they can't after the event retrospectively try to do it. But, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the winemakers, giving the winemaker that choice is the best thing to do because they don't have to choose it.
And are all bids sort of final if approved? Because you must have their credit card details or something so that, you know, it would be a nightmare. You know, 500 people after event. Now, can you pay your money? Oh, no, the pay hasn't gone in yet. And all of a sudden, your numbers would collapse on you. So you store people's credit card details so that they bid, you win the auction, you've paid your money, and it's delivered.
Correct.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough too. Can you bid over?
No.
You can't bid over what the winemaker wants. Okay, fair enough. And do you think this marketplace is a good idea or a bad idea? Or
whether it'll work or not, you know, with all these things, you have to keep tweaking it.
Mm.
It is that process of continual change that eventually gets you to the point where there's definitely a market for winemakers to communicate directly with customers. And there's no particular reason for us to be in the middle of that. Exactly how we configure it and what it looks like, time will tell.
You've got your angel investors. I saw somewhere on your website you've got archangels. Is that right?
Yeah. So we've got customers, angels, and archangels. Archangels, there are about 200 of them, are the customers who are most connected, most communicative, most helpful to our other customers. So we take them off to trade tastings, that kind of thing. They go and visit the winemakers. And they are the ones who really land up picking the wine and defining price.
Do they have more knowledge than everybody else, or are they just more happy to, more engaged?
They're just more engaged. And, you know, we specifically don't want people who are wine geeks.
Yeah.
Because we want people who like wines normal people like.
One of the problems I find with a lot of wine recommendations is that my palate's different to your palate.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a normal distribution of things like tannin tolerance and all sorts of stuff. So do you find that you get problems with someone who really likes a wine whose palate is quite different to someone else's palate, so it becomes harder to make someone to make a recommendation? Because I normally tell people, if you want to experiment with confidence, you find a wine journalist who's broadly in line with your style, and then you can experiment quite happily, because if they recommend something, there's a fairly good chance it's going to be in line. Whereas if you don't like tannins or something like that, there's no point listening to someone like Jancis Robinson who loves crunchy, high acid wines with tannins and that. And if you're not into that, absolutely pointless. So does that become a problem, or how do you manage that within your site?
No, we try to introduce people to customers who got taste like them, but have tasted more wines.
Mm.
You can see if you like a particular wine, we'll show you, well, here's another person who also likes this wine. Maybe you should follow them.
And I signed up for your stuff last night, and I went through, 30 wines or something like that, or some ridiculous number of wines. You know, what do you think of this? Because I like all wine, basically. Yes. I'm sitting there going, yep. Well, not my favorite, but I can understand it and I can enjoy it. Yep.
I'm a bit the same. Following me just means you get everything.
Yeah. So it's more about trying to match people with it. And these archangels, do they do anything special with the wineries themselves, or this £20 or whatever? How does it get invested in the wineries?
The broad idea is we use that money to get a better price or better quality. And that can vary from, at one extreme, setting somebody up in business completely from scratch, to at the absolute opposite extreme, just giving somebody a year's worth of purchase orders in advance so they know the wine is sold and they can bottle it.
Is it actually? But you haven't actually sold it in advance, have you?
No, we haven't.
So you just say, look, we will guarantee. So do you get stuck with stock?
Well, the customer's paid us the money for this wine.
Not for that particular wine, no, though.
No, for wine.
For wine.
And we've got an idea of what, pretty good idea of what the customer's like. So we order what we think we're going to sell. And if it lands up, you know, if we order a year's worth of wine and we sell it in 10 months or 14 months, it's not really a big problem. Obviously, and this happens, if we order a wine that turns out that we've got it wrong and the customers really don't like it, then you've got no choice but to discount it and get it out and not repeat the mistake.
What about vintage variability? Because you're obviously purchasing before the last winter frost and rains that occur that destroys the crops and wipes out the quality of the wine. So you're making a purchase order decision before, it's even before on premiere, at least in on premiere, you get to try the wine.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, when we have found ourselves in a situation that a follow-on vintage has just been not of the right quality, you basically got two choices. One is you find some better quality wine and blend it in to bring the quality up to where you want it to be, and you take a financial hit in that year. And the other choice is we say, well, you know, you can't polish a turd, so we've got to get rid of this wine. And we sell it off in bulk in the local market and split the loss with the winemaker.
Okay.
On the financing side, what we do as much as possible, and this is accounts for probably 60% of our wine and the percentage we want to build, is to give the winemaker the assurance that the wine is sold, reduce their risk. We pay them a third, a third, a third. We pay for a third when at harvest time, so cover the cost of the grapes. We pay a third at bottling time, so it covers the cost of dry goods. And we pay the other third when we collect. The winemaker knows, we're not a company who's turning up to say, oh, we're going to sell lots of wine, give us a great price. We have bought the wine, we've paid for it. In some cases where the winemaker is working almost exclusively for us, we pay the guys fixed costs, we pay them a salary. Because what we really want to do is to have the real cost of the wine being the variable cost, which means we kind of price it as aggressively as possible to our customers, which means they buy lots, which means the winemaker gets to make enough wine that they can earn a decent living out of a wine that's competitively priced. There are an awful lot of guys caught in a situation where, you know, they're making 1,000 cases, and for them to earn a living on 1,000 cases, the wine is so expensive, no one's ever going to buy it. So it doesn't go anywhere. So we'll try and work with them and go, look, you know, you've got to make 10,000 cases in order to get the price down far enough that people are going to buy it. And to make that, you're going to have a big investment in grapes, but we'll make that investment in grapes for you. So that's how we try and bridge the sort of price-quality-volume divide.
You've paid your third for the grapes, you've paid your third for the dry goods, and you find the wine's naff because of some bit of bad luck, rains, yep, or whatever. Is it that last third that you share the pain with them when you...
Yeah, and bear in mind, you know, if you've got a wine that's going to be retailing in the UK for £10 a bottle,
yeah,
the actual cost of the liquid is less than half of that, which means that if you sell it and take a loss, it's much better to take a 30-40p loss than it is to ship the wine over here, bottle it, and then have to take a £5 loss to clear it.
You've been going now for, what, 2 years?
Just over, yeah.
Have you seen that there are certain producers who are starting to get a reputation? Have you seen an inflation in their wines as... You know, so say you've got a producer whose first vintage was absolutely brilliant. People know they really enjoyed that wine. So the next year, people are willing to pay a bit more for that wine. You know, how is the reputation coming through on the bottom line?
The pricing's all done on a cost-plus basis. So the only reason price goes up or down is if the grape price has changed or there's inflation. So the winemakers don't say, oh, my price has gone up 10%. But sometimes grape prices go up, sometimes they go down. That filters through into the final price. What does happen, sadly, is that sometimes winemakers try and get clever. And they'll do the first vintage will be blowout, and the second vintage, you taste and you go, this isn't the same wine. And, you know, if it is, we in the situation where we'd be selling it off at a loss. It's pretty rare. I don't know if we've just been lucky, if we've got particularly nice guys as winemakers. What I hope it is that we are enough of a chunk of business to these people and a good customer to do business with because of the financing arrangement, that it's not a smart thing for them to do to annoy our customers. So generally, and when I say generally, I mean there have been 3 wines we've had to return and say, sorry, this is not what you said it was.
Yeah.
So pretty much generally, winemakers seem to be look after their long-term interests by looking after our customers.
You did say earlier that the winemakers set the price for the wine. I got confused because then you said earlier it was grapes plus cost.
Two completely separate things, right?
Yeah, okay.
One is in the marketplace, the winemaker sets the price.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
In the core Naked Wines business, we work on a cost-plus basis.
If someone's doing a great job year in, year out, they're not necessarily going to be able to capture that reputation enhancement within the Naked Wines portfolio. Is that right?
From a price point of view?
Yeah.
No,
of volume, they can always produce more.
If you look at the average price per bottle the winemaker's getting, that grows over time. And the reason it grows is we try with every winemaker to have an entry-level wine, a medium level, and a premium level. You know, none of us make any money on entry-level wines. They are there, like the same reason BMW makes 3 Series, to get people to buy in, trust the brand, trust the winemaker, and then over time they migrate up the chain. So what we want is the bottle prices to remain constant or change if the inputs change, but over time, the winemaker makes more money because the premium wines go from being a tiny percentage of their sales to the majority of their sales. And, you know, we're in our third, fourth vintage with a few winemakers. And it's been interesting tracking the average bottle price because there's been significant growth. The only growth inflation the customer's seeing is duty and VAT. So I think that's a happy situation. You know, I think it's a great fallacy that British consumers won't pay for quality wine. It's much easier to say to a customer, you know, you like Chris the winemaker, you've bought his £6 wine, why don't you try the £8 wine, see what you think.
Does he make more money on the £8 wine?
Gets a bigger margin.
Oh, it's a percentage margin as opposed to a
sometimes it's a percentage, sometimes it's a fixed amount. But obviously, if a premium wine has got a lot more energy and a lot more work in it, it takes more time and more energy to make, then we're happy for the winemaker to make a bigger margin.
I think we're going to wrap it up there, Rowan. Thank you very much for your time.
Great. Nice to see you.
Cheers.